Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, The Two Treatises of Government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.
Is it temporary, or is it just a one-time thing?
I'm a guest shark.
You're a guest shark?
I got a bunch of episodes this season. Here, hold on. We got to take this selfie.
We're going to do a selfie on the... Are you going to tweet that out?
Of course, yeah.
As a Twitter investor, you need to do that. By the way, I noticed this today. I'm not required to do that.
There's no quota.
Today, did this just happen today on Twitter? Instead of starring or favoriting your item, it's now turned into a heart?
Yeah.
What is that about?
It's a few things. It's favorite is a superlative, so... Even since the earliest days, we're like, is this tweet really my favorite? Am I going to have to take some other things out of my favorites to make room for this thing? And so it's just a lower bar gesture. It's just a lot easier. And frankly, the Facebook guys pioneered the space of like, let's just make it as easy as possible for people to react to content. And like and heart is just much less of a commitment. So the Instagram guys showed that. You know, you can double tap anywhere. And basically on Instagram, double tapping doesn't necessarily say you're in love with that thing. It's just an acknowledgement even. So I'm proud of the Twitter guys for taking that step to make it easier today.
We'll get into Twitter and Jack Dorsey and all of the things that you've been saying about Twitter in just a moment. Given that the topic is playing for the long term, I wanted to ask you both about this, but I want to start with you on this, Peter, because you have it's just a great story. A lot of people here may know the story, but it's worth telling because of the lesson in it, which is to say that many years ago, many moons ago, Yahoo came to you, to Facebook this is, and said, we want to buy you for $1 billion. Mark said, no. You said, maybe. What happened?
Well, we had it was July 2006. We had a board meeting. It was myself, Jim Breyer, Mark Zuckerberg, the three of us were on the board. I think the two investors probably thought $1 billion would be pretty good. You know, with $40 million in revenues that year. It was not profitable.
So you wanted out.
It was still just, it seemed like a good financial deal.
A billion was a huge number then.
And billion was a lot. And Zuckerberg, you know, it was sort of, we had a long conversation. You know, it's a lot of money for you, Mark. You'd make about a quarter of the money personally. And I was like, well, I don't know what I'd do with a quarter of $1 billion. I'd just start another social networking site, kind of like the one I have. So why would I sell it? And at the end of the day, he convinced us that they were still working on all these new product features that were not being valued properly. We figured Yahoo wouldn't go away, and we sort of ended up going with his judgment. But he thought it was going to be a 10-minute conversation to turn it down. It was a 6-hour conversation, but...
Has that changed anything for you in terms of now, how you think about investments?
Well, I already had a strong pro-founder bias, so my default was to go with what Mark thought. But this certainly is a very big difference between a founder-led company and a professional CEO-led company. If you had a professional CEO, there are many things they would have done better in the early days. But if you'd had this sort of conversation, the first thing they would have said would be, I can't believe they're offering us $1 billion. That's so much more than this company's worth. I have to just make sure I don't screw up the sale. Right. So it would have been a really different kind of a conversation.
Okay.
And you don't have to get many of those things right or wrong to get very different outcomes.
Flip it around. Uh-huh. Because at Twitter, there have been opportunities to sell.
Well, to Facebook, actually. So Facebook made an attempt, more than one, actually, to buy Twitter. And I remember Ev and Jack and Biz calling me from the parking lot of Facebook, like, what do we do? And I happened to be with Dick Hostelo in Hawaii at the time. And I called him over, and I mean, this is long enough ago that I was still carrying a BlackBerry. I remember, like, standing in this field in Hawaii on speakerphone trying to figure out whether we should sell the company for, like, $700 million. And I haven't gone back to figure out whether that trade would have actually worked out. If we'd done it, who knows? There is this just, one of the things I think doesn't always process to investors sometimes is how much these companies are driven by the passion and the obsession of these founders. And so it's not a trade in those instances. You can't just kind of think about it in terms of sheer economic value. There's so much identity, there's so much passion There's just, as he said, like, what would I do next? What would I do if I didn't have this company?
Okay, so explain this, and I know it's probably hard to put a criteria on it, but you look at somebody like Elon Musk, who you've spent a lot of time with, you partnered with him early on PayPal, but obviously you've been a big investor in SpaceX and Tesla. Were you solo
city? Not in Tesla, just SpaceX.
You're not in Tesla.
Yeah, we never invest in Tesla, but we just
Because?
We had a categorical anti-clean tech bias in the 05 to 08 period, which, you know, we should have not been as dogmatic. We should have just...
Al Gore is going to be here in a minute. Why do you have that?
Well, we thought the valuations were very inflated and people were very crazy and there was sort of a lot of insanity around it at the time, you know. But it turned out. I mean, Tesla was the one company that actually did work from that whole ensemble. Right. It had all the feelings of a bubble where people were not thinking, you know. There were sort of a lot of businesses were undifferentiated, like the e-commerce companies in the late 90s in the internet space. You had sort of, you know, 20 different thin film solar panel companies. You couldn't tell the difference between. When you have those sorts of dynamics, you want to be careful.
But what is it about the? Is there a criteria that you use when you think about the founders that you're going to invest in? Because both of you have talked about investing in people, perhaps even more than ideas themselves.
Yeah, well, I always I don't separate the ideas and the business strategy and the technology that much from the people. I think it's all sort of a complicated package deal. But I like companies that are extremely mission-oriented, where there's a strong counterfactual sense of mission. If we don't work on this problem, it won't get solved. So SpaceX, it would be, this is the only place where we're going to go to Mars, which, you know, people may say that's sort of a crazy part of the story, but that is really what drives Elon with the SpaceX, and that's what inspires a lot of the people who the rocket scientists who work at SpaceX. If there's no other company that's planning to go to Mars, and if you think that's a very important problem to work on, that's the only company in the world you can work on to solve that.
It's kind of an incredible thing to invest in Uber, Instagram, Twitter. So there has to be some kind of screen going on in your head.
Yeah, I mean, I approach it a lot less thematically. You know, I'm pursuing. So, first of all, your dogma about clean tech worked out. Other than that one company, you're right. Right, there was a bubble there. You know, we have a very small team, so I'm not doing a ton of sector analysis. I'm not making big predictions. You know, Uber kind of presaged the sharing economy, but that wasn't a thing then. Like, you know, nobody had kind of wrapped their heads around that as a concept. So for me, it's way more people-driven than probably most investors. And what I look for, and some of this has been regression analysis and figured out why a bunch of our deals worked. So we have 11 of the fabled unicorns now, and I've kind of looked at each of those founders and also looked at, you know, the kind of autopsies, if you will, on some of the companies that haven't worked out, and seen that with our very best founders, when you talk to them, it's clear from day one that they believe in the inevitability of the success of their company. They don't use conditional language to talk about it. They use simple future tense. So when I met with Kevin Systrom of Instagram, he was one guy coding, and he just said in a sentence very casually, "And so when we get to 50 million users, we'll roll out this." And I'm like, dude, have you noticed? You're alone right now. Like, you're in a co-working space at a shared desk. And he just said it so calmly, not cocky, but just knew it was inevitable that he'd succeed. You know, with Travis knew that he was going to completely disrupt not just transportation, but logistics, things moving around the planet. And he would talk about it with that kind of sense while sleeping on my couch up in Truckee and hanging out in our hot tub. And so he just knew it was going to happen. And I mentioned to you, Travis is so obsessively competitive. And even as one of his close friends for years, I didn't realize it until New Year's Day. My dad, who loves his Nintendo Wii, challenged Travis to a Nintendo Wii tennis match. And they're playing, and Travis is like hungover. It was New Year's Day. You know, he's kind of like sleepy on the couch. And my dad is just getting his ass kicked. And he says, "Travis, what the?" I mean, there's one game where my dad doesn't score any points. And Travis pages over to reveal he is ranked number 2 in the world at Wii Tennis, while also being the CEO of Uber. Like, that's not normal, right?
I'm not sure that would be normally considered a positive sign, by the way. But that
is not a normal person. And so when I look across, like, the people that succeed aren't actually that balanced. They're not that normal. They're kind of weird, and that's made us a lot of money.
Oh, well, let me ask you.
The personalities are often very extreme, and there is always this degree to which a lot of the people who invest in these companies don't identify with them that naturally. So if you think of the standard, even the standard venture capital track is people who went to business school, got an MBA, and there's a certain social milieu they're comfortable in, certain types of people they're comfortable with. Yeah. And so, you know, you have to, there's always two parts to investing. One is what's fundamentally right, and then sort of what's mispriced in the market. And so there's something about these extreme personalities that's systematically mispriced. And a lot of investors will react to this and say, you know, he's so obnoxious, I can't wait for that person to fail, or that's sort of very often the emotional reaction right. You end up having. And so there's, I think, this very odd systematic mispricing.
Let me ask you a question, and this goes to sort of the Steve Jobs question that I think was asked in a Rolling Stone column, which is, can a good man be a great man? Which is to say, when you talk about people being balanced, this is sort of the jerk question. Can you actually be, you know, shoot the moon successful and also be a good guy, or do you really have to have a little screw loose to get there?
Well, I think it's always framed too negatively. That's an exhibit A for what I was just saying, that people are way too fast to attribute all sorts of awful things to Jobs. You know, all the biographies on Jobs, the lesson you draw is that he succeeded because he yelled a lot and was this impossible manager. There was the Isaacson biography, there were all these mid-level managers in Silicon Valley who gave it to employees in sort of a way of saying, I'm going to become a jerk. You know, I'm reading this biography, and I'm going to try to be like Jobs, and that means being a jerk. Whereas the question you really had answered, if all of that was true, is why did he inspire people in spite of it? And I think it is something like what Chris described, where there's something about the vision, the mission, the certainty that things were going to work, that inspired people in spite of whatever shortcomings he had. So I think I think these people are not, they're never really evil people. They're never as evil as they're portrayed. And they're not always, you know, simply good, but never as evil. They're always portrayed more evil than they are.
I think a lot of it sometimes is just they're decisive, right? When you get the professional MBA running a company, everything's done by committee, it's slow. Founders and the best entrepreneurs can be incredibly decisive, and that rubs people the wrong way sometimes. I think the other thing that happens is impatience. You know, walking into a meeting with Larry Page, you're reminded constantly that he is an alien who's been sent to us from the future. And so, you always feel a certain pressure to not entirely underwhelm him with your idea. And just, you know, the look you'll get is the, really? I'm giving you 3 minutes of my short life to listen to this right now. And so I think that could obviously rub some people the wrong way. But those of us who got to work with him were completely inspired by the magnitude and the ambition of that guy's thinking.
Chris, let me ask you about this. Every person we talked about so far, and you guys, are men. I said, can a good man be a great man? Earlier this year, there was the Ellen Pao saga in the Valley, and you tweeted out, verdict aside, we have a deep gender discrimination problem in tech. Thanks to Ellen for reminding us, let's not let the conversation end here. So let's not let the conversation end here, which is to say, what do you think is happening in the Valley, and do you think it's changing at all?
It's changing, slowly. I mean, just the numbers are really clear. So our companies are almost entirely run by white guys. The boards are almost entirely white guys. There's this, as David Sachs called it, this kind of country club mentality of these board members who are just professional board members who kite from company to company. And yet, look at the user base of Twitter. Like, you have black users over-indexed to Twitter, and yet we don't have any representation of that audience in the upper management or the board of that company. And that's just weird, right? We're guiding things for an audience we can't address. And so what happens, strangely, is we have a company called StyleSeat. It's run by a woman. Most of its users are women, half of whom are black women. Do you know what it's like for that woman to go raise money up and down Sand Hill Road, pitching it to, I mean, even the first time she talked to me, she's like, what do you pay for your haircut? I'm like, $19, it's a supercut, you know? And I had no idea what some women pay for their hair. And I certainly didn't know how much some black women pay for, you know, extensions and weaves and that kind of thing, what a big piece of their disposable income it is. And yet when you dive in, it's one of our most successful companies ever. What I have noticed is among our companies that are run by women, they're just nicer places to visit. They're much better board meetings to go to. I feel like the discussions are more patient, the decisions are reasoned, there's less drama. I actually am starting to over-index that way, not even out of like an affirmative action standpoint. It's just a better life, frankly. So,
Peter, you want to add in?
Well, I agree with Chris that I think it's you know, it often gets sort of seen as a problem on the level of, you know, getting more women into engineering or more on boards or things like that. I think the level on which the problem probably has to be solved is on the level of the founders, because I think that's what sets so much the tone for Silicon Valley. And so I think it will change once you have more women who've successfully founded companies, because that's what sets the role model much more powerfully than all the other components. And I don't have all the answers on what you do about that, but I think that's the problem you need to think about.
But we have a culture, though, that doesn't teach girls financial literacy. And we have this princess industrial complex that even if you go into a Target right now, they'll have two sticker packs. The boy sticker packs literally says sports and careers, and the girl says princesses and fairies. And so, you know, I have three girls now, like 4-2 in a few weeks. But we will, you know, at night, before we go to read books, we do what my four-year-old calls a gotionation. We negotiate how many books we're going to read that night. Some of you have probably seen I periscope the stock report with my four-year-old, and she lets you know like how Twitter's doing that day and whether we're making money or losing money, and then, you know, implores the Twitter employees to work harder and smarter. But I really do think we need to start at that level of this culture. You know, we guys are taught from an early age how to bluff and pitch and sell. It's part of our courtship and dating. It's part of sports. And women in our culture aren't raised that way. And so I actually find one of the challenges we have with women running companies sometimes is they don't actually know how to like puff and bullshit a little bit. And we work on that. I also see that there's a bias in our language. One of the things we found is that there's a Silicon Valley accent. When we talk out there, we end a sentence on an upbeat. So we say, you know, and it comes from a professorial standpoint. If I were explaining an algorithm to you and I draw on the whiteboard, I'm like, so we have variable X and we're going to add that to variable Y. And so what it's implying is, are you with me? If I talk like that, I sound like I'm teaching you something. But if a woman says, so I have this new company and we're raising $50 million, like, you laugh her out of the room. You don't give her the credit she deserves. And so there's a linguistic barrier there that's just, I mean, it's so pervasive that, you know, when you asked what makes a good man a great man, it didn't even occur to me that was kind of a bullshit question that had all that, all that gender shorts. But no, it's going to take decades to unravel all the layers of this.
Let me ask you a different question. We've gone 20 minutes and we have not used the word bubble yet. So let me posit the question to you. Are we in a bubble right now when it comes to the private tech world?
I'm totally curious to hear what he has to say.
Well, I don't think we're, I think a bubble, valuations are high. I don't think we're anywhere near the 99-2000 levels, and I think that if there's a bubble today, it's certainly not centered on tech. I think for there to be a real bubble, you have to get the public at large involved. So bubbles are these psychosocial phenomena, and the reality is that the public has not been involved this time around, unlike the late 90s. There are not enough IPOs. There were something like 35 tech IPOs in 2014, 300 in 1999. Public's just not involved. If there's a bubble today, it's in, you know, it's with the money printing, it's the government bonds, and that seeps into lots of other things, including tech.
But you don't think there's a private bubble, meaning you've said publicly you think Uber is over, and now we're at $70 billion.
No,
I think you might have said that.
I've never said it's overvalued.
No?
You know, I've never said it's overvalued. We're investors in Lyft. The competition's really insane. You know, you can get me to say all sorts of things about Uber that are not that nice, but I've never said it's overvalued.
I have it here. I think Uber is quite overvalued. I think that if you have Uber at $18 billion versus Airbnb at $10 billion, Airbnb would be the better investment.
Well,
that's a relative value claim. That's very different from an absolute claim. You changed that on me. Yes, I would. Long short, I agree. I still stick with that. But that's relative value. That's not absolute.
Just to be clear,
Mr. Sharp?
I've said Lyft goes away. So
you say Lyft goes. Well, yeah. Bring it on then. Okay.
No, I just don't think there's room for a number two in this space. That's a whole other panel. We only have a few minutes, but I'm just trying to draw some of the heat off this guy.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, no, I'm not going to go. Well, look, it's Uber's been a super aggressive company, and there is always a question how aggressive you can get away with. And I'm on record as saying I think it's the most ethically challenged company in Silicon Valley.
Why?
You push the envelope, you break the rules. You always have to break rules a little bit. Question is how much you break them, how far you push the envelope. Napster pushed it too far. You know, if you sort of call your company Napster, you nap some music, you nap a child, you're a kidnapper, people might get suspicious, and there's a problem.
He's saying Uber, that you're invested in a morally corrupt company, and you're giving argument about...
Not more than corrupt. I didn't say more than corrupt, just a little bit. Just a little bit corrupt.
Look, here's the funny thing. So in the early board meetings, I was the guy saying, don't go down market to where Lyft is. I don't want to be on price. I don't want to be beat on price. But I was like, don't go down market, because what's happening there is actually illegal. And our point of pride was that Uber was legit, that we complied with the law in the cities we were in. And yet, what would happen is we would still get cease and desisted. We would still have the cars seized. Travis was facing like a month in jail for every day he continued to operate the company. That's not bullshit. That's a real number. Like, so, you know, the fines were mounting that were well beyond the capitalization of the company. And I regret actually not going to the Lyft end of the market earlier, now in retrospect. But I just kept saying, those Lyft guys will get pushed out because they're breaking the law, and we'll be legit. And frankly, I was wrong. Like, they lumped us, basically the incumbents lumped us all in together and just treated it as this big, horrible space. And so, strangely enough, I think the Travis that you see now, who is very aggressive, who considers this to be a campaign, you know, against taxi, and he's a reaction to the actual corruption that we would start to see. I mean, we'd board meeting after board meeting, we'd just be like, I can't actually believe this is happening in the United States of America. You know, suitcases full of cash, influencing politicians completely against the interest of their citizenry. You know, we know Uber and Lyft like decrease drunk driving. We know it's safe. We know it's more accountable. We know they provide jobs, flexibility for veterans, et cetera. Like, we know all this happens, and yet we see these cities still vote against, you know, formalizing and legitimizing the space. And that's, I mean, when you are working every day in the face of that, it's hard not to respond and start to lose faith in the system.
I want to open up for questions just one moment. I have one final question for you, which is about comp. Comp in Silicon Valley. You used to always talk about how you wanted people to be paid a very little bit amount of money.
Moderate amount.
A moderate amount of money. I thought you, I don't know, what
do you, what do was you have that quote there too?
I do. I do.
150K was the limit.
150K was the limit in terms of the investment. You now have companies, and a lot of publicly traded companies, Twitter, Google, where you have executives who are paid 70, 100 plus million dollars at the same time that they're laying off remarkable numbers of people. What is the comp situation in Silicon Valley still make sense to you? Or did it ever?
Well, certainly there's a very big difference between a public company that's been around for 17 years or so, like Google, versus a startup context. So in a startup context, I'm always very concerned that the founders, early employees, are aligned with investors in creating more value on the equity, and so high comp there is always a bit of a red flag. In the later stage companies, the scale is often so large, and the leverage you get from people is so large that it probably is critical to try to retain the top people. There's a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge that gets built up within these firms. And so, if you've been working at Google for 7 years, 10 years, you'll have a lot of other opportunities. And there's actually a lot of value in, if you've been doing a good job, for them to keep you in that firm because of all the institutional knowledge that gets built up. And so I do think the leverage is very large. If you look at a place like Google, it certainly has not been hurting the profits in a crazy way. And so it probably is the right calculus for them.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's been rumored that Twitter tried to poach Sundar years ago, and it's been rumored that Google paid him $200 million cash to stay, right? That was money that Twitter couldn't keep up with. But I think that trade worked out for Google, right? I mean, where does Alphabet or Google end up if they don't have Sundar leading it? One of the most effective executives in the history of the Valley. And so absolutely, if you look at it as a leverage equation, I mean, Larry Page used to say a good engineer is worth 100 times more than an okay engineer. And so one of the things I actually look for is I'd like to see a little bit more disparity in some of the pay around the most talented people. It's just when you know somebody's a franchise player, I don't have any problem incentivizing them to the moon.
Let's open up for questions. I imagine there are a lot. By the way, let's plan to blow through the clock a little bit here because I know there's people who want to ask some questions. Go ahead.
Hi there. So, you know, venture capital in Silicon Valley is radically different as a culture than Wall Street, but they both function as a gatekeeper and as a bottleneck to the deployment of capital. So what do both of you make of the Jobs Act and the potential for what's now a very, very tiny space in terms of crowdfunding and using disruptive technology to raise capital as a potential going forward? And it's much more than, you know, the Oculus Rift getting $2 million on Kickstarter, which isn't really crowdfunding.
And I feel like you just put the new tagline for my website, like bottleneck and gatekeeper to the deployment of capital. Like that, maybe my business card should say that.
Or not, as the case may be. So what do you make of this? I mean, is this going to disrupt venture capital?
Well, the general investor question I always think is you always want things that are fundamental and contrarian. And so to make it a good investment, you always have to be aware of the context. How many people are you competing with? If it's something way too many people are looking at and are overbidding, even if it's a fundamentally good company, it may just be an okay, not a great investment because it gets bid up way too far. Now I think that I'm not as worried as perhaps I should be about some of these innovations and new sources of financing, because I think that we always find a lot of investments that are unique, and because it is such a large market, there's so many different companies that exist, it's so incredibly inefficient that I think it's one that's very difficult to systematically rationalize. It's hard to rationalize if you have a single site where you show all these companies, no one can look at them all and compare them. Even if you have a very large venture firm that looks at everything, the information internally tends to break down. And so they will look at all deals, but only one person in the company might look at all the deals, and then it gets somehow lost internally. So it is somehow, there's something about the ecosystem that I think is structurally super inefficient and always will be.
I mean, I was one of the first Kickstarter investors. I'm a big believer in the platform, but not as a replacement for venture capital, but instead a real, you know, it's a nice patronage model. It's a good kickstart on, not to use that term, on pre-selling products, on the prototyping phase. I love it to see ideas get actually put to manufacturing without having to give up any equity is fantastic. That said, I'm worried about the crowdfunding stuff from the perspective of the crowd investor. I think we've seen this play out decades ago, and it led to a very bad scene in the world economy. There's just so little information about these companies. In the seed market right now, like, there aren't boxes of documents to go through and due diligence. And I have the capacity to absorb risk that I don't think mom and pop America have. And so I think the frenzy that we saw, you know, in 2000, people, you know, basically, we should have all known there was a bubble when every sports bar turned off ESPN and turned on CNBC, right? And I think that's going to happen in startups if we really let the gates open. And there's going to be some really sad stories there. You know, I'm happy to see more competition in the market. I think companies should have access to capital, but I actually worry about the impact it's going to have for the investors. And the last thing I'd say is, money isn't money. Like, I'll take Bill Gurley's investment at a 50% discount to somebody else's investment because I know the impact he's going to have in one of our companies. And I think there will be this kind of quality factor writing stuff out where the best investors add. They materially impact the outcomes for these companies. And it's not going to happen from dentists and lawyers dropping a few coins into all these different pockets. It's going to happen from professionals continuing to help. I know that sounds like self-serving and protectionist, but it's where I come out.
Let's sneak one last question right over here in the front.
This question is more for Chris. You mentioned you think Lyft's going away. Do you think that applies broadly to all the Me Too companies, and does that imply a bubble?
Do you have any other questions? I mean, I just like, it's just like a negative question to end the whole thing on,
we'll,
right?
We'll go to another question. Let me try one cut at this. It's always bad to be a Me Too company. The question is, what is a Me Too company? People would have said LinkedIn was a Me Too company in 2008, where they said, oh, it's just a social networking site like Facebook, it's going away. Yes, if you have two companies that are absolutely identical, that can be a problem at some point down the line. But there's some very subtle differences that can make a very big difference in these contexts. And then there are things that can, people would have said, you should have never invested in Google. It was a Me Too social, Me Too search engine in 98. There were already so many different search engines. Google would have been a Me Too company. So getting these categories right is one of the biggest sorts of mistakes people make.
Okay, let's do the final question
what he
here.
Said.
We're going to go real quick because I know we're totally out of time here.
Yeah, I'm expecting my first child in 2 months. It's a girl, so I'm very happy to hear the comments you had. But I had a question for both of you about what do you think the cost of college is going to be in 18 years and what's going to happen to the future of education in this country in terms of higher education?
Well, he doesn't have any thoughts on college, so I'll take notes. Go ahead. Go ahead, man.
It will keep going up until someone does something to change it. You know, the future doesn't exist in this. I want to key off what Chris said about entrepreneurs. That you can say something definite about the future when you create it. You can't say something definite about it in terms of just something that exists out there. So the cost of college, will keep going up at a faster than inflation rate till people develop alternatives that work on all the, educationally and from a signaling perspective and all the different ways. And socially, in all the different ways college works. Until that happens, it will keep going up at a rate faster than inflation.
I mean, I deeply believe in the value of college, particularly a liberal arts education. I'm a little bit of an outlier in that. I think college is an opportunity to learn with a capital L, and later you can train. What I worry about is how unidimensional a lot of computer science students have become as a result of the rigor of the curriculum. They don't get to study abroad anymore. They don't have summer jobs. They've never waited at any tables. And so what you get is a 23-year-old engineer at Google yelling at the chef because they've run out of pheasant that day. And they don't understand how people get by in the developing world. They've never met anyone who's struggling to pay back loans or payday financing a check. And so I really worry about how homogeneous our culture is getting within Silicon Valley because of the lack of opportunities. So I deeply believe that college isn't necessarily the requisite vocational training at all, but I certainly look around and I see that some of the most interesting people I know, like Stuart Butterfield, who runs Slack, he's successful because he's fascinating and interesting and has had this wealth of experiences in his life. And so I hope that it's at least affordable enough to get your girl to college. Yeah.
Peter Thiel, Chris Salk.
Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, The Two Treatises of Government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right. Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.